All right. Good morning, Garden City. Welcome. So good to be with you guys. Special welcome to our live streamers who are hanging out at home. We're excited to have you with us. Just a few things to just remind you of before we really dig in and get going this morning. First thing is offering. We're not passing the baskets, but if you have a gift in hand that you would like to give, we've got offering baskets in the back that are there for you. In addition to that, kids are downstairs, and you can check them in downstairs if you'd like. If you want to keep your kids with you, you're welcome to. We've got a table in the back filled with coloring things, so families can hang out back there, or adults with limited attention spans, you are welcome to use the tables as well. If I were not here, I would be sitting at the table coloring, so that just let you know that's where I would be. I would be listening, but I'd also be coloring, so that's available back there. Also, we've got these witty signs that if you need extra space around you, you know, 6 feet is recommended. If you need like 9 to 12, then you feel free to place these around you. And it's just a friendly way of saying, please don't sit here. And they are very witty. I just want to draw attention to Paula Kuzman, who's our worship leader, who is also our captain of witty sayings, who came up with these. So Paula, thank you so much for going above and beyond and coming up with the fancy sayings on the signs. Also, just a reminder that the 9 o'clock service is our intention here is that this is like the precautionary service. We've got people at our church who obviously who are at home and they're at the greatest risk. And we've got some people who are at risk but willing to courageously step out because they're in a place where they're able to do that. And the 9 o'clock is the service where we want those individuals to be. We can't promise safety. That's not within our power to do that. But we want to create an environment where the risks are minimized as much as possible. And so with that, we're encouraging masking at the 9 o'clock, encouraging distance. You know, some of you guys are huggers just at the 9 o'clock. Just don't go in for hugs just because you don't know. But this is the place where we want people to be comfortable. And we've got masks in the back thanks to Lisa DiPaolo, who I took one last week and I've been rocking this since. But we've got masks. If you need one, they're right in the back. Okay. Also, just a reminder: many of us are doing a read through the Bible in a year. And so, how many of you guys are doing that? Anybody? Yeah. So just a reminder that's still going on. And I have been doing it, and just I think it's incredible. And I actually started in the Old Testament and just have been working my way through sequentially. Some people are doing it differently, but it is so good to rhythmically, you know, every few years to just read through the whole story and catch all the things that God is doing. So just a reminder that that's happening. And the DiPaolos actually have a group. If you're not in another small group, we've got a group of people that are doing that together. And if anytime you want to jump in, you're welcome to jump in. Okay, so if you want to join us, where we're going to be in the Bible this morning, we'll be in the book of Matthew. And we're going to start out in Matthew chapter 21. Okay, so to let you know, we're in a new series this morning, but that will make sense here in a little bit. We're going to come back to Timothy, but we're going to do a little mini sermon series here in October, early November. Okay, so when I was a kid, I remember every single day at school, we would start off our school day by pledging allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And because we did it every single day, it was just kind of the thing that we did. Like, you couldn't go into your school day without starting with the Pledge of Allegiance. And I think I did that all through elementary school and then even into middle school. And I think somewhere around the end of middle school is when we stopped doing that. But how many of you guys grew up that way, that every single day you would start off pledging allegiance to the flag of the United States of America? Okay, so when I graduated, and we were all impressed and amazed that I did. When I graduated middle school, that kind of like ceased to be a pattern for me, right? I didn't then, in high school and college and off into my young adult and adult years, I didn't wake up pledging allegiance to the flag. I didn't continue that practice. But it was probably 5-6 years ago where I was invited to do a chapel at a local Christian school. And, you know, I was there and the kids were coming in and I had my Bible in hand and my little message to the kids to get them roused up for Jesus in their day and all those things. And everybody was seated on the floor, and I was you know, getting ready for my introduction to come up. And then the school had everybody stand. And then all the kids, you know, put their hand over their heart and started to recite the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And I hadn't seen that in years, hadn't been around it. And I'm not making a judgment here, but it just struck me as odd because I'd been so far and so long removed from it. And I just began to think, like, wow, this is, like, I did this every day growing up. Like, what is happening here in that we are pledging allegiance to a flag of a country, right? And I had my chapel notes here all ready to go, but my mind started to wander into, like, what does it mean to be allegiant to a nation, right? Because and then something happened after the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, in that the kids launched into another Pledge of Allegiance, but it was to the Christian flag, which was totally new for me. And so, like, I was kind of, like, struck me as odd that we were pledging allegiance to the United States, but then I didn't know that there was a Christian flag, and I was having a hard time getting my mind and my heart wrapped around, what does it mean to pledge our allegiance to a Christian flag? All right, and then, so my mind is racing, and I'm just, like, perplexed and trying to get my wits about me, and then I had to stand up in front of these students and talk about something totally different, right? We're in a new series, and the series is entitled Seek Ye First. And the thought behind this is the question, to whom should we be pledging our allegiance? And it's fitting that we would do a political series here in what may be the most tumultuous political campaign that we have seen ever in our country. I'm sure there have been worse, but for those of us that are alive now, this seems to be the craziest, right? So we're just going to lean in over the next 3 to 4 weeks. We're going to lean into politics, and we're going to look at what Jesus says about political life and about allegiance and about all things related, right? So there's three words that if you don't understand these three words, you're not going to understand what we're talking about this week. And here they are. The three words that are going to be very important for us are authority, allegiance, and fruit. Okay? And we're going to see this in several stories that we're going to look at this morning. Authority, allegiance, and fruit. Okay, now the real passage that I want to get to is actually later, right? We're going to get there later on this morning. But in order to understand the place that we're going to get to, we have to understand it in its context. And in order to understand it in its context, we have to look at the things that come before it. Okay, so we're going to look at some things that come before the real passage that I want to talk about. We're going to meander our way there, but I think that by the time we get there, we will understand these things, which will unlock the passage that I really want us to lean into, and then the next several weeks, we will build off of that. Okay, so Matthew chapter 21, we're going to start in verse 12, and Jesus is right towards the end of his ministry, and he is headed into Jerusalem, and the first thing that he does is he heads to the temple. Okay, so here we go. Matthew 21, starting in verse 12. And Jesus entered the temple and drove out all who sold and bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. He said to them, "It is written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer, but you make it a den of robbers.'" Okay, so when Jesus comes into Jerusalem and makes his way to the temple, what Jesus is doing is he's actually heading home, and he refers to it as his home. What does that mean? Well, remember, the temple is the place where heaven and earth intersect. The temple is the place where God dwells, and then people come into proximity with him. We've spoken about that quite a bit here. Right? And so Jesus comes to his home, the temple, the place where God and man intersect, and his house is an absolute wreck. It is in shambles. Particularly, it's in shambles, morally speaking. Right? Last week, remember, we talked about character. Character is lacking in the temple. Right? There's people that are ripping others off. They're extorting people for high prices regarding the sacrifices. It's just a cesspool environment. Now, it's interesting that the temple is the one place on earth that you would expect to find deep character and high morality, because that's where God is dwelling with people. And then, right, and then the culture permeates out from that place. but we find the opposite there. So what Jesus does when he comes back to his home that is in shambles is he starts to clean house. And he flips over the money changers' tables. He starts clearing everybody out. Jesus engages in some violent housekeeping because it's necessary for him to do so. Verse 14, right? Then, and the blind, those who can't see, and the lame, those whose bodies aren't working very well, they came to Jesus in the temple and he healed them. But when the chief priests and the scribes saw the wonderful things that he did and the children crying out in the temple, "Hosanna to the Son of David," they, the religious leaders, were indignant. They were furious. Right? So it's very interesting here that the blind and the lame are drawn to Jesus, and the chief priests and the scribes, the religious leaders, are furious at Jesus. Right? In literary circles, this is what we would call a reversal of expectation. Right? That those that you would think would be on the inside program of what God is doing, the religious leaders, they actually find themselves on the outside, and those that you would expect to find on the outside, the blind and the lame, right? Maybe God is judging them, that's why they're blind and that's why they're lame. Those that you expect to be on the outside of God's purposes actually find themselves on the very center and on the inside of that which is God, what God is doing, right? So in the religious leaders, you would expect to find them submitting to the authority of God. They are not. You'd expect the religious leaders pledging allegiance to the rightful King Jesus. They are not. You would expect the religious leaders to be bearing good fruit. Well, the temple is evidence. They are not. But those that you would think are on the outside, they are submitting to Jesus' authority. They are pledging allegiance to him and running to him, and they are beginning to bear fruit in keeping with the kingdom, namely pledging their allegiance and following and receiving and revering Jesus, right? A reversal of expectation is happening here. Now, verse 18. Continue. In the morning, right, so Jesus leaves the temple, leaves Jerusalem, heads out of the city, then comes back the next day. In the morning, the next morning, Jesus was returning to the city, and he became hungry. And as they're walking towards Jerusalem, he sees a fig tree by the side of the road. And he went to it and found nothing on it but only leaves. No figs, no fruit, only leaves. And he said to it, "May no fruit ever come from you again." And the fig tree withered at once. Now, if this was just your daily quiet time reading and you read this out of context, you would think that Jesus has a problem with nature and that Jesus has a bit of an anger issue. But when you read it in context, it becomes very clear what Jesus is doing. The context here is that Jesus goes to Jerusalem, particularly the temple, and he's looking for fruit, and he does not find any. Right? And so the next day, upon this scene, he comes upon a fig tree, and Jesus is yearning for fruit. There's no fruit there. In not seeing fruit on the fig tree, what Jesus does is he pronounces a curse and a judgment on the fig tree. What Jesus is ultimately doing is he is pronouncing judgment on his people for not bearing the kinds of fruit that you would expect if they had their allegiance to their Father, if he were really their authority. Right? This is a judgment scene. And so the cursing of the tree is exactly that. It's a picture of that which Jesus is doing as he cleanses the temple. Now the question is, on whom is Jesus pronouncing this judgment? Remember, right, we're in a season here in Matthew of a reversal of expectation. On whom is he placing judgment? Then verse 23. And when he, Jesus, entered the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came up to him as he was teaching and said, "By what authority," it's one of our words, "Jesus, by what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority?" Right, the religious leaders are saying regarding the temple, "Jesus, this is our domain. This is our house. We belong here. We're the authority structures here. Who are you?" Meaning, you don't belong here, you need to get out of here. So the religious leaders are rejecting the authority of Jesus. They're not pledging their allegiance to him, and the fruit that we are seeing in the temple is evidence of all of this. And upon these people, Jesus is pronouncing judgment. Now, from this place, right, we're going to just weave through some stories here real quick, because Jesus begins telling some parables, and all of these parables are essentially saying the same thing, and we've just laid, or Matthew, I should say, by the Spirit of God, has just laid the groundwork for what Jesus wants all of us to see, and we all need to grapple with this, and this may be uncomfortable for us, but remember, Jesus disciplines those that he loves, right? So we need to receive this, and we need to be open to this, okay? Now, the parables start in verse 28. And we're going to start cruising through here. Here we go. Here's stories that Jesus begins to tell, essentially saying the same thing that he's already said. Jesus says this, what do you think? Speaking to the religious leaders there and everybody else who's listening. What do you think? A man had two sons, and he went to the first and said, son, go and work in the vineyard today. And the son answered, I will not. I will not go to work in the vineyard today. But after he said this, he changed his mind. And then he actually went and he worked in the vineyard. Verse 30. And the father went to the other son and said the same thing. And the other son answered, I will go work in the vineyard, sir. But he actually ended up not going to work in the vineyard. Which of the two did the will of his father? The one who said, I'm going to go work, but didn't, or the one who said, I'm not going to go work, but did? Well, the religious leaders, those listening, said, the first. Jesus said to them, truly, I say to you, the tax collectors and the prostitutes go into the kingdom of God before you. The point of the story is that the prostitutes and the tax collectors are giving the impression that God is not their authority, that they have not pledged their allegiance to him, and they're not bearing fruit in the kingdom. Their lifestyle declares, seemingly almost verbally, that they are not following the Lord. But remember, reversal of expectation. When Jesus actually shows up on the scene, the true king, what are the tax collectors and the prostitutes doing? Well, they're flocking to him. Now, the religious leaders, they seem to give the impression that the Lord is their authority. And it comes out in the way that they dress. It comes out in their credentials. They look the part of those who are pledging allegiance to the authority of their father. Right? And everything that they wear and everything that they say seems to indicate that there is fruit there. But when Jesus arrives, these people actually reject him. Right? The reversal of expectation game is on. And then Jesus keeps hitting it. Verse 33, a new parable. Hear another parable. There was a master of a house who planted a vineyard and put a fence around it and dug a wine press in it and built a tower. And he leased it to tenants. And then he went into another country. Right? Jesus essentially here is telling the story of the Bible. When the season for fruit drew near, he, the owner, God, sent his servants to the tenants to get its fruit. Priests, prophets, all the people that would be in these roles in the Old Testament. And the tenants, the Israelites, the tenants took his servants and beat one, killed another, and stoned another. Again, the owner of the vineyard sent other servants more than the first time, and they, the tenants of the vineyard, they did the same to them. Finally, the owner of the vineyard sent his son to them. Why, this sounds like what God is actually doing right now. Finally, he sent his son to them, saying, they will respect my son. But when the tenants of the vineyard saw the son, they said to themselves, this is the heir, come. Let us kill him and have his inheritance. And they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and they killed him. The fruit reveals who the authority is for these tenants in the vineyard. They're actually seeking to kill everyone that the owner sends to them, and they've actually now killed the son of the owner. They are not honoring the owner of the vineyard as their authority. They're not allegiant to him, and the fruit, killing everybody, is evidence of that. And Jesus is saying, this is exactly what you are doing right now. You've taken over the vineyard, you've taken over the temple, and you've driven God out. You're not receiving the rightful king. And Jesus says this in verse 43, therefore I tell you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people producing its fruit, right? So Jesus is looking for fruit, and fruit comes from those whose allegiance is to him because he is the authority over all things. Verse 45, when the chief priests and the Pharisees heard his parables, they perceived that he was speaking about them, right? Congratulations, leaders, for perceiving that Jesus is speaking all of this about you. You finally entered into an understanding of that which Jesus is saying. Now the question is, are you going to receive this or not? And then in chapter 22, essentially Jesus tells one more parable saying the same thing. Jesus tells a story about a king who has a son who's getting married. And the king is pumped and he throws this massive wedding feast. And he invites all the people that you would expect a king to invite to the wedding feast of his son. And you would expect that the king, who's the authority, that has a bunch of subjects who've pledged allegiance to him, that the fruit of this would be that in this particular scenario, when a feast is thrown, that these subjects would come and enjoy the wedding feast. But Jesus says, here's the strange thing in this story, none of the people who the king invites come to the party. They've got jobs to do, and they've got other things to attend to. It's just not a big thing for them. They don't care about the wedding feast, right? And that says something, because they're not coming to the wedding feast. It says something about whom their allegiance is to and who their true authority is. It's not the king. And then from that point, Jesus says, well, then the king, who's got this party to throw, then, right, sends out messengers and servants and says to anybody and everybody, come on in. I've got this wedding feast. I've got this party. And I need this thing to be filled up because the party is going to happen, right? And so here's the point of all of this. Those who were invited to the party, those who you would expect to be there did not choose to come. And then the others who you would not expect to be at the party, they actually show up. Same variations on a theme. The religious leaders, you think they're on the inside. They think they're on the inside. Everybody thinks they're on the inside of what God is doing. And Jesus says they're on the outside very clearly. And those that are on the outside, the lame and the blind and the tax collectors and the prostitutes, they're the ones that are actually coming into the party that God is throwing in Jesus, right? Reversal of expectation here. Now, in verse 15, we finally get to the passages that I really want to talk about, but we needed to understand it in context here or we'd miss some things. Verse 15, then the Pharisees, a religious leading class, right? Part of the, you think they're insiders, but they're not, right? Then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle Jesus in his words. Okay? The religious leaders, the ones that you would expect to be the closest to God, are actually now seeking to kill God in the flesh. Verse 16, and they, the religious leaders here, they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians saying, teacher, here's how they're going to try to catch Jesus. Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully, and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances. Tell us then, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Now, have you ever heard people in America say you don't want to tangle with the IRS? Right? You want to fill out your taxes in the right way because when the IRS gets in your life, things get complicated. Okay? So do things the right way and the IRS will leave you alone and life will be simple. Right? In the Roman Empire, When the Roman Empire IRS got involved in your business, it wasn't just that you got audited, right? If Jesus here is a high-level leader, people are flocking to him, he's making a scene. If the religious leaders can get Jesus to insinuate anything in a political gotcha moment that Caesar is not the Lord of all and that your allegiance is not to the authority of Caesar, And if it's in the realm of taxation, because Caesar, the authority, is really big on taxation. He wants your money. And if he thinks that there's anyone out there who's saying that you ought not give him his money, then what's going to happen is you're not going to get audited. You're actually going to find yourself on a Roman cross, and your life will be taken from you. Because that's what the empire does, right? You do not mess with taxation regarding the Romans, or your life is on the line, which is why the religious leaders are seeking to trip Jesus up regarding who is really the ruler here, right? Regarding Caesar and taxation and authority, because if Jesus misses his words, then the religious leaders will do what we do in our political environment. They'll take something that Jesus says out of context, throw it on the cover of the New York Times or USA Today or whatever, and then we'll just let the political machinations work and Jesus will ultimately be killed. This is what the religious leaders are seeking to do. They want Jesus gone, and they're going to use the Romans to take care of their dirty business, right? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Here we go, verse 18. But Jesus, aware of their malice, right? Jesus sees down to the heart. It's not hidden from him. But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Here's the truth." And he says this, "Show me a coin for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this on the coin?" They said, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Well, therefore, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And when they heard it, the religious leaders who were trying to kill him, when they heard it, they marveled, and they left him, and they went away. And now, finally, the authority of the religious leaders has been identified. It's finally now become clear to whom the religious leaders are pledging their allegiance to, because now finally we see the fruit for what it is. Verse 16, the followers of the Pharisees that are coming to trip Jesus up, who do they show up with? Verse 16, and they sent their disciples, the religious leaders sent their disciples to Jesus along with the Herodians. Who are the Herodians? The Herodians are the political party of Herod. Who's Herod? Herod is a provincial territorial leader in the hierarchy of the Roman Empire. And the Herodians, actually, like they're like, hey, we think Herod is awesome. Some historians believe that the Herodians thought that Herod was actually the Messiah. That Herod was the one who was going to come in the line of David and sit on the throne of Israel and bring peace and thriving and joy and flourishing. Now, if you know anything about Herod, you know that Herod was a messed up guy. He was wicked down to his core. Like, he murdered all the babies 2 years old and younger because he saw a political rival on the horizon. Like, Herod is a wicked individual, but the Herodians love Herod. They want to see Herod lifted higher. They want to see Herod's territory expanded because as they allot themselves with Herod and are pro-Herod and Herod's rule grows, well, good things happen to them too. Their pockets get filled and their power gets more pronounced. So the Herodians are just into the Herod thing because it serves them, right? Now, here's the interesting thing, that regarding the religious leaders, they've got the Herodians on speed dial. Anybody remember speed dial? I don't know if that's a thing anymore, right? But the Pharisees, they call up the Herodians, and it's like, now it's time to work with them. Like, they've got a cordial working relationship with the Herodians, and now they're going to become bedfellows in this co-plot, because the Herodians don't want to see a political rival to Herod on the scene, and the Pharisees obviously hate Jesus. So now these guys are getting in bed together, and they're teammates in getting rid of Jesus. And then in verse 19, right here, the fruit comes out again, right? The religious leaders are partnering with Herodians, and Jesus then, right, gets them again here in verse 19 when he says, "Show me, religious leaders who are trying to trap me, show me a coin for the tax." Do you want to know if I think you should give taxes to Caesar or not? I'll answer that question maybe. "Show me a coin for the tax." And they brought him a denarius, and Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness is an inscription is on this coin that you've just produced for me?" And they say, "Caesar's." Caesar's likeness is on the coin. Interesting, because we just came off of the temple cleansing scene where the religious leaders are extorting money from people so that they can deepen their pockets with what? With images of Caesar. They're selling out their countrymen, and they're using forgiveness and sacrifice, and they're using the temple, the place where God and mankind intersect. They're using that to fill their pockets with Caesar's likeness, so that when Jesus says, hey, you want to talk about taxation and Caesar and what should we give to him? Show me a coin. And all these religious leaders are like, well, my pockets are filled with them. Let me see if I can just grab one. Right? And then in this scene where the religious leaders are bedfellows with the Herodians and they've got Caesar's image all around them because that's what they're about, Jesus says this, right? Here's my answer. Give to Caesar which is Caesar's and give to God that which is God's. And what Jesus does, he just drops the mic. And everybody goes home because they have nothing left to say. Because the fruit, they're aligned with the Herodians, and they've got Caesar images in the form of coinage all about themselves. That's all they're about. The fruit reveals to whom their allegiance is to. Their allegiance is not to the Father. It's not to the creator and sustainer of the heavens and the earth. It's not to Jesus. That's not to whom their allegiance is. No, their authority is actually something very, very, very different, right? And the religious leaders, it becomes clear that their authority is Caesar, that Caesar's empire has become the cosmos that they are happily swimming in, and God has been squeezed out because Caesar and Caesar's way and Caesar's truth and Caesar's life have become so attractive to them that there is no space for Jesus' way and Jesus' truth and Jesus' life. And it's clear to everyone. Now, here's the danger. That if we're going to, right, so when you read the scriptures, we have to read it in the way that they are written. And as we read this, we have to be very mindful that we not be the ones for whom a reversal of expectation is working against. Because we're here at church on Sunday morning and we're watching the live stream. We could be doing a whole bunch of different things. And maybe some of us are giving money and we're tithing and we're seeking to do good things, right? We give the impression, like the religious leaders, because of some fruit that we could point to, that Jesus is the one whom we are allegiant to because he is our authority, right? But the reversal of expectation is always unexpected, as it is here for everyone who is listening to this in this moment where Jesus gets them, and he gets them good, and he reveals the truth, right? So we can look good, we can have it all together like the religious leaders, and it can seem like we're on the inside of what God is doing, but we need to ask the question, is that really true? That's the point of all of these verses that we've just looked at. As human beings, we are constantly at risk in making our way through life without Jesus, right? In our hearts are just, they're nasty places a lot of the time for those of us that are familiar with what really goes on in our heart. And we are always looking for ways to make our way forward and to build our life without being allegiant to our King and our authority, Jesus. I mean, think about it like this. This is less the case now, but for us, but historically, many nations that have been like really cool nations have suffered from what we call nationalism, right? That nationalism or their excitement about being American or Canadian or Swiss or Congolese or whatever nation you're from, that becomes our authority. Like the biggest thing in our lives is that we are residents of this country and we are these people. Sometimes we do that with ethnicity, right? That our authority becomes our nation. Our allegiance is pledged to this authority, and then the fruit that we bear is to that authority, right? We need to be really careful. And sometimes we think that our justification or that which makes us acceptable and right in good is because we are Americans. Now, as I said, that's less the case right now because America's having a little bit of an identity crisis and we're not sure if many of us, it's just a weird environment, right? But here's what we are more prone to right now regarding seeking our justification in this particular season in American history. We are in danger of seeking our justification through the lens of our political party affiliations. Right? I don't know if you watch the news. If you don't watch the news, good for you. But if you do, there is this near religious zeal and fervor for your particular political party. And I don't care which party you ascribe to. But it's right. It's as if in this season that we see right the prime authority in our lives is our political party, and we're pledging allegiance not to the flag of the United States, but pledging allegiance to the Republicans or the Democrats or the whoever, right? And the fruit is of that is all around us. We have a sense that because we have chosen the right political party, that makes us justified and acceptable and pleasing. And because of that, we're good and everybody else is bad. And if that's you, then you better watch out, because the reversal of expectation is coming. And Matthew would rather us see that now than later, right? This is a checks and balance now, so that the reversal of expectation doesn't happen to us later, right? So regarding justification, be very careful that you do not think that you are right and acceptable and good because you have chosen whatever political party you have chosen, and you are uniquely right and everyone else is uniquely wrong. If that's you, a reversal of expectation is coming for you, and it's not good when that happens, right? We're constantly at risk at making our way forward without Jesus regarding justification. Also, think about identity. Identity, like who we are and how we see ourselves. It seems as if in this season that people primarily see themselves as Republicans or Democrats. That's how we imagine ourselves through the lens of our political ideology. We need to be really careful that we do not do that. Because what Jesus says is, he says, "Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and render unto God that which is God's." And essentially what Jesus is making here is, he's making a contrast between big and small. Between big and small. Meaning that God deserves our big, and your political party affiliations deserve your small. Whereas oftentimes we like to flip that. So what that means is, right, whatever government leaders you're for, maybe you're for the left, maybe you're for the right, I don't care. But whatever government leaders you are for, what Jesus is saying is that they deserve your small, meaning you can vote for them. That's great. Cast your ballot. That's small. If you want to put a sign in your yard, that's cool. That's small, right? That's appropriate. If you want to give some campaign time to your favorite political leaders or your political party, I'm sure that's fine too, right? We could fit that under the category of you giving that your small, right? But now in contrast, what Jesus deserves, he deserves our big, meaning that Jesus deserves not just a vote or a sign in the yard or some campaign time. Jesus, because he is the sole authority in all the heavens and the earth, that our allegiance to him should be in keeping with his magnitude, which means our whole lives are his. We prostrate ourselves before him in every part of us all the time, right? That our justification is found in what he has done for us. Our identity is rooted in who he says we are, and that we bear the image of him, right? We owe him all of our allegiance because he is the sole authority in heaven and on earth. And when we do that, then we'll start to see a certain kind of fruit that comes from that, right? Give your political party your small and give Jesus your big. Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. Give him some coins. That's what the Romans say. Do it. But give God your everything. Give him all of it. And then give Caesar a bit. That's how this thing works. But what we are prone to do is we want to give Jesus a little small trinket, side note, maybe give the impression that there's more going on there than there really is. We want to give Jesus our small, and then our big is something else. It's our political party, it's our country, it's our ethnicity, it's our whatever it is for you. Fill in the blank. We are constantly in danger of that. And if we don't think we're in danger of that, we're missing everything that Matthew is telling us. Those who think they're on the inside are on the outside, and those who we think are on the outside are actually on the inside of what Jesus is doing. The danger comes when our political party becomes our whole life and Jesus simply gets a vote. So what the Spirit of God, I believe, is seeking to say to us through Matthew here, what Jesus is saying as Matthew documents it, is that we have to get our authority structure straight. Who is our sovereign? To whom then are we pledging allegiance to with our lives? Because once that becomes clear, then the fruit will come that reveals to what authority our allegiance is being pledged. And in this day, right, in this moment in American history, it's very clear, right? Maybe this is just me. Maybe you're on a different page here. I don't know. But I think we need less fruit from those who have pledged allegiance to a particular political party because that political party has become their dominant authority. I think we need less of that fruit in and around and among us. And what we need is we need way more fruit from those who have pledged allegiance to the one true King who reigns over all, whose name is Jesus. And that's what Jesus is longing for. And he's throwing a party, and he's invited all of us, and he wants us to come in and to enter into his joy and to exit the angst of the political nastiness that is all around us, to exit the political angst and to join into the joy-filled party. Because that's what happens when Jesus is king and Caesar is not. Over the next few weeks, we're gonna build off of this, and we're gonna expound upon this, maybe in some ways that you would not expect. But we're gonna take this season, this unique season of our American life, and use it as an opportunity to look at some things, maybe in ways that we've never seen before, because we need to. Because Jesus is inviting us into something magnificent, and we don't want to miss out on that for something that is far, far less. All right, band, come on back up. We're going to sing a couple more songs and just kind of ponder this and think about it. And in worship is one of the things that we do to pledge allegiance to our authority, who is Jesus. So we're going to have the opportunity to do that. So as the band comes up, let's pray. And Ryan, would you come back up and help me with the board? Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you so much for inviting us into this party that you are throwing. God, it's very different than our political parties that are being thrown. And Father, I pray that we as a church in this season would be the ones who flock and to run to you and to enter into that which you are doing, that we would give you our big. And then regarding our political affiliations, Father, that those things would be appropriately small, that we would render unto you our whole lives, and we would render unto Caesar that which is appropriate. Help us to give you our big and to give our political party and our country and all of these things our small, so that we might be seen as and evidenced as fruit bearers before you. Thanks for loving us enough to invite us into this. In Jesus' name, amen.